Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at how the prayers of the early church displayed the unity of their community. Papal Election Milestone. On the eve of the 7th anniversary of Pope Benedict's election to the See of St. Peter, we explore the figure of the Pope as a man and as pontiff, with the help of two major experts. Vatican Library Going Digital. In collaboration with the Bodleian Library of Oxford University, 1 million pages of texts from the Vatican Library are to be digitised and will be freely available online. And we find out more about this project. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on Christian prayer by looking at how prayer showed the unity of the early Christian Church in speaking the Word of God with boldness. Emma McCarthy reports.
Touring the square in his open-top Popemobile, well-rested after a period spent in summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, Pope Benedict thanked pilgrims who waved enthusiastically, holding up giant banners with birthday greetings. As a special birthday gift, he asked them to pray for him so that he may persevere in his service to Christ and his church.
Dear brothers and sisters,
then the Holy Father returned to his series of catechesis on prayer, as recounted in the fourth chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, inspired by the story of Peter and John, who were imprisoned after the healing of a paralytic because they had announced the resurrection of Christ.
The community joined in prayer, and the place where they were gathered together, was shaken. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and spoke the word of God with boldness. This prayer shows the unity of the early community, which asked only to proclaim the word of God fearlessly in the face of persecution. It seeks to discern present events in the light of God's saving plan and the fulfillment of prophecy in the mystery of Christ. It also begs God to accompany by his power the preaching of the gospel.
In comments in Italian, this, he said, is something that should always be fundamental to the church.
May this prayer of the early church inspire our own prayer upon all things picking pilgrims and visitors and work the churn peace of the risen Lord.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
I signori cardinali hanno eletto me, un semplice, umile lavoratore nella vigna del Signore.
The cardinals have elected me, a simple, humble worker in the vineyard of the Lord. Those were the modest words Pope Benedict used to describe himself in his first public speech following his election to the papacy 7 years ago this week. Those much-quoted remarks helped in some ways to set the tone for Pope Benedict's reign. So what exactly do they reveal about the man who became the 256th pontiff in 2005, following the death of his predecessor, blessed Pope John Paul II? One person who knows Pope Benedict well is Jesuit Father Joseph Vessio. He's a former theology student of Joseph Ratzinger at a time when he was professor at the University of Regensburg in Germany and was also a student at many of the Ratzinger summer schools, including after he became Pope. Father Fessio is founder and editor of Ignatius Press that has published the English translation of almost all of Joseph Ratzinger's books. He began by telling me how he first met the then Father Joseph Ratzinger and what impact he made on him then.
It was in 1972, because I was coming to the University of Regensburg and then West Germany to start my doctoral studies. And so I had him for a teacher, both in class and in the seminars, and then he was my doctoral director. As far as impact, he was a wonderful teacher, had many, many students who would be very faithful to come to his classes, a lot of doctoral students. And he was then what people see now. He was very kind, very intelligent, listens well, very serene, good sense of humor. I mean, we all loved him. And when he became Pope, we were very happy, not just because we could say our teacher was Pope, but he had got a reputation as being very harsh and severe as the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and we knew that wasn't true. So we were very happy to have the whole world finally find out who this man is.
So he was a person, as you said, who had a good sense of humor, very patient. He never lost his patience.
We never saw him do it. I only heard of one instance in his entire life where he actually got angry and lost patience. Now, he, of course, thinks very quickly, and he's got a kind of ironic sense of humor, so he can see the negative, but he takes it with equanimity and doesn't seem to react outwardly.
Do you have any personal anecdotes or stories concerning Pope Benedict or the then Joseph Ratzinger that were particularly inspirational for you and that you could share with us?
You know, I'm often asked that question, Susie, and I have a difficult time remembering any particular moment or anecdote. But I can say this, that when we used to concelebrate with him, we'd have meetings with him as his former students every year. And when he began to celebrate Mass, no matter where you were, no matter what the circumstances, it became a very sacred act. I mean, he just totally put himself into the liturgy. And his love for the Mass, his love for the liturgy, has always inspired me and his other students as well.
Now, he's known, of course, to have a very intense prayer life, but is there any one particular saint that he has a special devotion to, or is it a group of them?
I'm not aware of any. You know, in his interview a couple of years ago with Peter Zewald, he spoke a lot about his prayer life and so on, and he does. He converses with the saints. Augustine is a particular friend of his, you know, Bonaventure. He's in that spiritual tradition.
Now, since that time when you were a theology student at the University of Regensburg, you have continued that association with your former teacher, the now Pope Benedict, by attending some of his summer schools, first in Germany and now in Castel Gandolfo, the papal summer residence. How would you describe these sessions, whose participants, of course, are all former students of his, like yourself? Are they quite relaxed in tone, or is it very much down to work?
Well, it's both, because we have different periods together. When he became Archbishop of Munich Freising in 1977, his students recognized that his academic career was, in a sense, over, and that was when they began what they called the Schülerkreis, the circle of students, who would meet once a year. Because his students were from all over the world, they didn't always come every year. I was one of the ones farthest away, so I would come every 2 or 3 years. And so the group was rather small, maybe 10 or 12 or 15. We'd have a weekend together. We'd have meals together. We'd have a seminar, invite some speakers. We'd have Mass together in the Divine Office. So there was recreation, there was conversation, there was study, there was intellectual exchange, and the group was kind of small. Well, of course, once he became Pope, we thought he would no longer continue to have this Schülerkreis session. But he surprised us, as he often does, saying no, he wanted to continue. Well, of course, now that he was Pope, everybody came. So we were at Castel Gandolfo, 40 or 50 of us, and it became a little more formal. You know, we'd have breakfast with him, and we'd have Mass with him, and kind of recreate a little bit, but basically it was a great big room with 40 people in it and having some back-and-forth discussion.
You're now editor of Ignatius Press, a Catholic publishing house that has published almost all, if I'm not mistaken, of Joseph Ratzinger's books in the English translation. What further insight has that given you into his thoughts and teachings, especially as regards his theology?
Well, first let me say that, yes, we have published almost all his books in English. There's one or two that came out before we got involved. But I realized soon, both as a student and then as the publisher of his books, that he wasn't simply a good theologian. He was really a creative and original theologian. He has two good friends, both deceased, Cardinal de Lubac and Cardinal von Balthasar, both great theologians in their own right. And the three of them were kind of, in my view, a triad of giants in the middle 20th century. And reading his books has just always been a source of nourishment and inspiration. He's always got something new. I mean, even now as Pope, he's talking all the time, writing all the time. You almost always find a new insight, a new idea, some new thought that will inspire you. So he's no question about it, he's one of the history's great theologians, and he combines both depth and richness with clarity. Really, he's someone almost anyone can read, no matter how difficult the subject matter is.
Let's go back in time 7 years until that April day in 2005 when Cardinal Ratzinger was elected to the papacy. Where were you at that time? And what were your thoughts and feelings when you heard the announcement that he'd been elected Pope?
Well, I wish I could go back in time in reality, but I can at least do it mentally. I know exactly where I was. I was at Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida. And normally, they say that the person who goes into the conclave as Pope comes out a cardinal, that you can't predict it. But I have to say, honestly, I really thought there was no other choice that had the qualities and the qualifications he had. So I wasn't really surprised. When I heard the bell ring, ran into the room, and the students were all there, the television was on, and of course I was very excited, but you know, it was kind of drizzling that day, and then suddenly the drizzle stopped, and the sun came out, and out on the balcony walks Cardinal Medina Estevez, who I've known for many, many years as a wonderful, great sense of humor cardinal. And I thought, is he the Pope, you know? But of course, he was announcing it. And he played it dramatically. Habemus Papam, Cardinalis Sanctae Romanae Ecclesiae Joseph. Pause. Everybody says, how many Josephs are there? Ratzinger. Well, of course, we just went up in wild cheers, and I think the world knows now why we were so happy. I mean, we've had such a great string of popes in the 20th and 21st century, but I have to say, none like Benedict XVI. I'm still happy.
Were you struck, as many were, by his very modest description of himself when he came out to give that first speech? As he described himself as a simple, humble worker in the vineyard of the Lord.
Susie, that was an example of his humor and irony. And I could almost see a twinkle in his eye, even on the television. I mean, he's sincere. I mean, he really, you know, has a modest view of himself, and he attributes his gifts and his success to God. But here he's standing out on a balcony with 700,000 people below and 700 million watching, and he says, I'm just a humble servant of the Lord. Well, yes, you are, Joseph, but I mean, what are you doing on that balcony then? So I think it's a combination of both his sincerity and his sense of ironic humor as well.
Now, of course, an awful lot has happened over the past 7 years. He's traveled to a lot of places, and I know it's difficult to summarize, but what for you have been some of the outstanding highlights of his papacy, the main features, if you like?
Well, let me say something, Susie, maybe a little unusual here. Pope, as you just indicated, does a lot of things, travels a lot, speaks a lot, meets people, makes decisions, and so on. But I think his legacy will be, and I think the most important thing a pope can do is appointing good bishops. And we've had, at least here in the United States and some other countries I'm familiar with, we have had some very, very fine appointments of bishops in the last few years. And to kind of underline that and emphasize that, I think his decision 2 years ago, whenever it was, to appoint Cardinal Marc Ouellet as the prefect of the Congregation of Bishops was a brilliant move. Cardinal Ouellet is like-minded. He's a brilliant theologian in his own right, speaks many languages, very personal, also has a great sense of humor and a wonderful singing voice, I might add. But he's someone who's very much in line with the Pope's thinking, and I think that's, in a sense, the most important congregation in Rome, because most people don't have a direct relation with the Pope, but they have with their priests and their bishop, and having good bishops is really important for the health of the Church.
Now, when it comes to some of his personal concerns, we know, of course, that he places a strong emphasis on new evangelization. Do you foresee that this is going to remain perhaps one of the dominant themes for the rest of his papacy, or are there other ones also up there at the top?
Well, that's clearly the top, because that's why he chose his name Benedict. I mean, Benedict was the apostle that really helped to make Europe into Christendom, and he sees that Europe is losing the faith, and by losing the faith, it's also losing its civility and becoming more and more secular. So, yes, new evangelization, that is to say, preaching the gospel again to countries where it has already been preached but has been lost sight of, that's a key motive of his papacy, and that's why he took the name Benedict.
I was speaking to Father Joseph Fessio, a former pupil of Pope Benedict. John Allen is the author of several books on the Catholic Church and one of the world's best-known commentators on Vatican and church affairs. He works as the senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter in the US. I asked him to step back in time and share with us his reaction and feelings on hearing the announcement that Cardinal Ratzinger had been elected to the papacy that April day 7 years ago.
Well, when the announcement of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger's election to the papacy was made, I was on air with CNN, so my main concern in that moment was trying not to make a fool of myself, explaining to the world who this man was. But more reflectively, I think I simply had a strong sense of the awesomeness of the challenge awaiting this humble, cerebral, rather shy figure that those of us who had been in Rome had come to know. Of course, taking over from John Paul II, he was taking over from one of the most wildly charismatic public figures of our time. So I had a prayerful sense of the massive challenge that was awaiting him.
7 years have gone by since then. What, for you, have been some of the most surprising things about Pope Benedict's papacy? Things that you might not have predicted beforehand?
I think the central surprise of Benedict's papacy is probably no surprise at all to people who knew the man, but it certainly has been a revelation to the outside world, which is the obvious contrast between the expectations that greeted his election 7 years ago and the reality, the lived reality of these past 7 years. At the time he was elected, of course, the popular stereotypes painted Joseph Ratzinger as a sort of strong, stern, authoritarian figure, you know, God's Rottweiler, the Vatican's enforcer, Herr Panzer Kardinal. And the expectation was that this would be a bruising, divisive, strongly authoritarian papacy. And in fact, of course, that has not been the experience at all. Instead, he has revealed himself to be a gentle, mild, relentlessly positive figure who has not become the great scold of the 21st century, but it has instead tried to offer the world a body of uplifting and edifying teaching. He has turned out to be a strong teaching pope. And so in that sense, I suppose the defining surprise is that the pope who has revealed himself to the world is not the one the world thought it was getting those 7 years ago in April.
I know it's difficult to single out one or two events or a work, but if you could single out some of the highlights from these 7 years, if you could choose one or two things, what would they be?
Well, certainly among the highlights of Benedict's papacy, I think, would be several of his foreign trips. Of course, when he was elected, it was not thought that Benedict would travel much, and frankly, it was not thought that he would travel particularly well. And instead, many of these trips have been both pastoral and communications triumphs. One thinks of his April 2008 trip to the United States, for example, or his 2010 trip to the UK. But I think Benedict XVI, at his heart, sees himself as a teaching pope. I believe he thinks that the aspect of his pontificate that will stand the test of time and that will still be of service to the Church 200, 300, 500 years from now will be its teaching. And in that sense, I think the highlights of the papacy have to be the three encyclicals. Deus Caritas Est in 2005, Spe Salvi in 2007, and Caritas in Veritate, his social encyclical, in 2009. I think those are permanent contributions that will still be read in universities and in seminaries by thinking Catholics everywhere. Centuries after, some of the other vicissitudes of this pontificate have been forgotten.
I was speaking to John Allen, author of several books on the Catholic Church and leading commentator on Vatican affairs. A million pages of manuscripts and ancient books from the Vatican Library will be digitized and made freely available online over the next 5 years. It's a collaborative project between the Vatican Library and the Bodleian Libraries of Oxford University that has been funded by a £2 million grant from the Polonsky Foundation. Under the terms of the project, the Vatican Library will be digitising 1 million pages and the Bodleian Libraries 500,000 pages from their respective remarkable collections. The prefect of the Vatican Library, Monsignor Cesare Pazzini, says the project will allow the library to expand its service by making cultural treasures available to a much wider group of readers and researchers. Founded in the 15th century, the Vatican Library houses a priceless collection that includes over 1.6 million books, more than 8,000 incunabula, or early printed books, and 75,000 manuscripts, including the oldest known manuscript of the Bible. The deputy librarian of the Bodleian, Richard Overton, spoke to me about what he called this exciting collaborative project with the Vatican Library. He began by describing how the idea for the digitization project first came about.
Well, the Vatican Library and the Bodleian had an established relationship for the past couple of years through a thing called the Centre for the Study of the Book, which is based in the Bodleian Libraries and has a number of international partner institutions who are mostly great research libraries. And we had already also here in Oxford been working with the Polonsky Foundation to undertake digitization of rare books and manuscripts. And the Polonsky Foundation was interested in extending their work with great libraries to include the Vatican, and they asked us to discuss the potential of a collaborative project with the Vatican Library, and we reached out to the prefect and his staff and were delighted to have such a positive response from them. And really, that's how the project idea evolved.
And how significant do you see it?
We think it's very significant indeed. In many areas of our collections, the Vatican and the Bodleian have very close connections in the history, the size and the makeup of our collections, and we feel that we will be able to make a huge impact to the scholarly world in developing a shared digital library of great books and manuscripts.
And what are some of the most ancient and most exceptional texts from the Vatican Library that will be digitized under this project?
Well, we haven't chosen the exact individual books and manuscripts yet. That's a process that we're just beginning at the moment, using our curatorial staff and a team of scholarly advisors. But we will be looking at ancient Greek manuscripts mostly from the early Middle Ages, where both the Bodleian and the Vatican Library collections are incredibly important. Also Hebrew printed books and manuscripts from the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, where, again, our collections are two of the most important worldwide. And finally, in very early printed books from the era of Gutenberg and subsequent decades, at the dawn of the history of printing in the West, where, again, our collections are of the most important kind. And we will, over the next few months, be undertaking a big exercise to scope in more detail exactly what we'll be digitizing, but they are the three main areas.
And what are some of the very oldest texts from the Vatican Library that are likely to be included in this project?
Well, they'll probably be classical and biblical texts from the very early Middle Ages, perhaps some from the 7th century onwards. Also manuscripts from the High Middle Ages, such as patristic texts, again Bibles, liturgies, commentaries, and also Hebrew materials from the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. Again, we haven't decided precisely what we're going to digitize as yet, but we'll probably include biblical commentaries, liturgical works, philosophy.
And how many pages will be made available in digital format, and how long will it take to make these ancient texts available?
Our project is scheduled to last for 4 years, and we aim to digitize 1.5 million pages or more during that time period.
And what kind of interest do you anticipate getting, both from researchers and the general public worldwide, to having these pages digitized? Have you had any feedback so far?
We haven't had feedback yet because we've only just made the announcement. So we're very much encouraging the scholarly community to send us suggestions, and we hope to be developing a priority list of requests from scholars all over the world of the things they would like us to digitize first. But we also have a small team of very expert scholarly advisors who are going to be working with us to help us develop the list of books and manuscripts that we would digitize.
And speaking as a librarian yourself, what are you most keen to see from the Vatican Library in a digitized form?
Well, there are a number of texts which are very complementary. I'm excited by the idea of reuniting books written by the same scribe in the Middle Ages that are now divided between our two collections, or books from the same printing shop in the 15th century. And I hope that we'll be able to look at materials that were acquired under the librarianship of Lucas Holsten, who was one of the early librarians of the Vatican Library, a German scholar who was also one of the first scholars to use the Bodleian Library in the first decades of the 17th century. So I'd like to digitize some materials that have a connection, that were touched by Lucas Holsten, both in Oxford and in Rome in the early 17th century.
I imagine a project like this doesn't come cheap. Is it very much due to the help of the Polonsky Foundation that you're able to go ahead with it?
We're hugely indebted to the Polonsky Foundation for their great generosity in providing the funds to enable this great digital project to go forward and to bring the Bodleian and the Vatican Library into this close collaboration. And without their support, this project wouldn't be possible.
And do you foresee future projects?
We very much hope that this will be the start of a series of projects, and look forward to discussing the potential for many others with our colleagues in Rome in future months.
And if you had to describe your feelings about the text that one can find in the Vatican Library, how would you describe it? I mean, what for you are some of its greatest strengths?
The Vatican Library is one of the most incredible libraries in the world, and it has so many riches and has such antiquity and great history in it, the development of its collections, that it's almost impossible to identify individual books or manuscripts. But it's just the thought of being able to unlock and open up the doors of the Vatican Library through the power of the internet to make its riches accessible to scholars that is the most exciting thing about this project.
I was speaking to Richard Ovenden, Deputy Librarian of the Bodleian Libraries of Oxford University in England. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.